I was wrong to be angry at him. Angels don't think like us. They don't understand. Fever went to him and kissed him. There seemed a strong chance that she might die soon, and she did not want to die without kissing him. She need not have worried about not knowing how. It turned out that her mouth had known all along. He tasted of the colour that you see when you lift your face to the summer sun and close your eyes. "Fever," he said when she stopped. It was very interesting, this falling in love. She understood now why people wrote so many plays and songs about it. But it was hard to concentrate properly, knowing that those men were coming, and that one of them was the man who had tried to squash her with a house. She made herself step away from Arlo and went to the fireplace, stirring up the embers there with the poker, throwing on fresh wood. She said, "Boil up some water, quick." "Why?" "And gather together some logs, stones from the wall, anything heavy."
"You're going to throw stones at them?"
"We're going to drop stones on them. We're 100 feet higher than them. That's 100 feet of acceleration, stored gravitational energy, waiting to be unleashed." She checked the big vise attached to the old table that served them as a workbench, fetched a hammer and a 6-inch nail. When she looked from the eastern window, she could no longer see the skiff, but she knew that was not a good thing. That meant it was close in now, hidden from her among the rocks and shadows of rocks just offshore. Maybe it was already offloading its landing party along the overgrown quay. Meanwhile, Arlo had set a big pot of water to heat over the fire and was making a pile of the biggest logs on the platform outside at the top of the access ladder. Fever prized one of the bullets free of the belt and clamped it tightly in the jaws of the vise, then dragged the table around until the bullet pointed at the doorway. She laid the hammer and the nail ready beside it, then fetched the heaviest things she could carry. Bits of the old engine cowling, a big wrench, a loose stone from the wall. She went outside to add them to Arlo's pile at the top of the ladder, and was about to go back in and look for something else when she heard voices below and the hollow clonk as a boat banged against the stone jetty.
"They're at the quay," said Arlo.
They were making no attempt at stealth. Some of them carried flaming torches, and they talked to each other in loud voices as they came up the slope from the quays. Only 5 or 6 of them, so Fever guessed that they were not expecting much resistance. She felt a fluttering sensation in her stomach. She needed the toilet, but there wasn't time now. 2 of the men had detached themselves from the rest and came right to the ladder's foot. One held up a torch. The other stood in the pool of light it cast so that Arlo and Fever could see his face. It was Fat Jargo. He shaded his eyes against the light peering up.
"Thursday, your little feathered friend told me where to find you. Will you let me up? We need to talk."
Arlo looked at Fever, and she could see that he was relieved by the fat man's reasonable tone. It would be easy to believe in that tone, to let Belkin climb up and talk to them, but Fever remembered too well her last chat with him. It was irrational to trust him. They could not let the goshawk fall into the hands of a man like that. Before Arlo could reply, she picked up a big stone and dropped it over the edge of the platform. It clanged off the handrail at the edge of the landing halfway down, and Fat Jargo skipped clumsily backward as it shattered on the ground just in front of him.
"Thursday, be reasonable," he pleaded. "Even you must see that you can't do this alone. The Octopus Cartel will give you all you need. Space, equipment, workers. They want to help you." "They'll have to come up and get me first," shouted Arlo, and he snatched a log and sent it hurtling down.
Belkin strode to the foot of the ladder, motioning angrily for the rest of his men. They came very fast, with the light splashing their running shadows on the cobbles and the weeds. Bald heads, bare arms, studded leather jerkins, wide belts with knives stuffed through them. They came barefoot, like sailors, making almost no sound. Belkin called to them as they started swarming up the ladder.
"Take them alive! I want the machine undamaged!"
Fever hefted one of the weightier bits of Edgar Saraband's engine, took aim, and let it go. It struck sparks from the ladder as it dropped. A man looked up at the flash, and she saw his eyes go wide in the instant before it crunched into his face. He fell soundlessly from the ladder, knocking over a couple of his mates, but the rest came on. She dropped another piece, and then she and Arlo started heaving logs over the edge. The attackers were ready for them now, and leaned sideways off the ladder to avoid the missiles. A few glanced off shoulders and leather-armoured backs on their way to the ground. But the men came on, and were soon on the landing. By then the pot of water on the fire was burbling happily to itself. Together, not speaking, Fever and Arlo ran to fetch it. In the short time that it took them to carry it to the ladder top, one of the attackers had managed to get almost up to the entry platform. They upended the pot over him, and he screamed and put his hands to his scalded face and went backward off the ladder and down, hitting the ground with a sound like a stomped snail. Were they dead? Fever didn't know. Did she feel bad about that? She saw no rational reason why she should. It was their own fault. If the men would just go back to their ship and sail away, if they'd only stop trying to get up the ladder... But the three remaining men kept climbing, and after a few moments more, all the ammunition was exhausted. Arlo snatched up the empty pot, and it rang like a gong on the bald head of a man who had made it almost to the platform. But he kept on coming. Fever shoved Arlo inside the tower and went in after him, shouting, "Get upstairs! Smash the machine!" She shoved him toward the staircase and scrambled over to the table where her ultimate weapon waited. Outside, the man heaved himself up onto the platform. It was Fat Jargo himself, wearing a ridiculous jacket with so many pockets that he looked like a chest of drawers. He glowered in through the doorway. Dribbles of blood covered his face like a red lace veil, spilling from a cut the falling pot had made. He was breathing hard after his climb. Fever picked up the nail and set it against the end of the bullet, picked up the hammer and set it against the head of the nail. Looked up to make sure that the vise was pointing right at Fat Jargo's vast body as he stomped toward her. She drew back the hammer and struck the nail against the bullet with one firm blow. Chapter 26 Night Visitors. The battle until then had been carried on in silence, broken only by scuffling noises, a few gasps and grunts, and that brief shriek as the scalded man fell. The sound of the bullet exploding was abrupt and startling, like an unexpected thunderclap. It filled the tower. It sent echoes slamming from the cliffs. Arlo froze at the foot of the stairs. Fever stood with the hammer clutched tight in her hand. The grin dropped off Fat Jargo's face like a picture falling off a wall. His eyes went wide with surprise, and he looked down at his own broad chest. Only the smoke moved, unfurling from the empty bullet casing. Then Fat Jargo looked up at Fever again, and his grin returned. Wherever the bullet had gone, it had missed him completely. Fever flung the hammer at him instead, but she was rattled now, and that missed too. Fat Jargo lunged at her across the room, roaring, as if the sound of the shot had been a signal that everyone was allowed to start making a noise now.
"You interfering bloody Londoner!" he shouted. "Why couldn't you keep your nose out of this?"
Fever saw something glint in the shadows under the table. It was the Aranya's bullet belt, and she snatched it up and swung it at the roaring face. But Fat Jargo caught it and dragged it painfully from her fingers and flung it across the room. She turned to try and run, but his hand was around her wrist, twisting her arm behind her. His thick forearm came across her throat from behind, cutting off her cry. She was slammed, face first, against the wall, his hot red breath on the back of her neck. Behind him, two more men came through the doorway. Arlo was running toward Fever, but one of the newcomers booted his legs from under him, and the other caught him as he fell, cuffing him viciously across the face when he tried to bite him.
"Right," said Fat Jargo. "It's done. Where's the flying machine?"
And the fire went suddenly mad. Something sprang up and started to roar and hammer there. A leaping fire snake, a rattling series of explosions that bled together into one long juddering noise, while tools and boxes leaped from the shelves on the walls, and the walls themselves started to come apart, scattering sprays of plaster and splintered wood like wedding rice. There were shouts and curses from Fat Jago's men. There was a shrill cry of pain and shock that sounded like Arlo's. There were whines and buzzings, a sense that the air was filled with small and speeding things. Hornets, perhaps, to judge by the way the men jumped and danced and clutched at themselves. Fat Jago suddenly rammed Fever still harder against the wall, pressing his immense and shuddering weight against her.
"What are you doing?"
she shouted, panicked by his brute bulk and by the noise. Fat Jago answered with a grunt, and his weight kept growing, forcing her down the wall to the floor, where he sprawled himself heavily on top of her. It was like being buried alive. At least the noise had stopped. There was a dwindling shriek as a man stumbled backward through the doorway and pitched over the handrail outside, a dull clang as his head hit a rung, a distant crunch, a voice far below shouting,
"What's that? Fat Jago! What's happening up there?"
The sounds came vague and underwatery through Fever's battered eardrums, where she lay crushed beneath the landslide of flesh that was Fat Jago. What was he doing? Was he trying to suffocate her? She struggled for breath, sure that her ribcage would give way at any moment. Her skull scrunched like an egg between his chest and the hard stone floor. Then Arlo was saying, "Fever! Fever!" And the weight on top of her shifted. She heaved upward with her shoulders and elbows, and Fat Jago rolled off her uncomplainingly, like an overturned sofa.
"The bullets," Arlo was saying. "The bullets out of the Aranya. He threw them in the fire and they..."
Fat Jago lay on his side and stared peevishly at Fever. A dozen of the Aranya's bullets had hit him in the back. He opened his mouth, and a bubble of spit formed between his lips and burst with a faint popping noise. Bock. That was the last sound he made. Arlo was saying,
"He threw them, and they landed in the fire, and they went off."
Fever made herself stop looking at Fat Jago, and looked down at herself instead, to make sure that she had not been shot without noticing it. She hadn't. Fat Jago's body had shielded her completely. But when she looked at Arlo, she saw that he was clutching a place near his right shoulder and that his shirt sleeve was dark and wet and dripping. She made him sit down on the steps and take off his shirt. There was a hole in his upper arm, a flood of blood. She tore a strip from the shirt to bind it and told him to keep it lifted up. Arlo obeyed meekly. There was an empty look in his eyes that Fever found almost more worrying than the wound. But maybe she herself looked just as bad. She went back out onto the platform, stopping on the way to help herself to a pistol that one of Fat Jago's companions had dropped. Outside, men were still shouting. Two of those who had fallen from the ladder had picked themselves up, though the others still lay where they'd landed. Angels whirled through the darkness, settling near the bodies, nerving themselves to start searching the dead men's pockets for snacks. Fever didn't like to stand exposed on the platform for too long, in case someone took a shot at her. So she ducked back inside and shouted,
"Fat Jago is dead! That's what will happen to you too if you try coming up here again! You'll never get the goshawk! Go away!"
She thought the men below might reply, but they didn't. When she peeked out again, they were leaving, limping back toward their boat.
"They're going," she said.
She felt absurdly pleased. She almost laughed. "They're just taking a break," said Arlo in a flat voice. "We surprised them that time, but there could be dozens more men aboard that galley. Fat Jago may be dead, but they know there's something valuable up here, and they'll keep trying till they get it." He was shivering. She went to him, trying not to panic when she saw how much blood had soaked through the bandages, trying not to remember Kit Solent, trying not to believe that Arlo might die. His face was pale, which made his freckles stand out even more clearly. She held him, and pressed her face into the scratchy cloud of his hair, and put her mouth against his ear and promised him, "It will be all right. I'll keep you safe. You can trust me." "I don't think I'll come to this island again," he said. "Bad things always happen here."
"What about the goshawk?" she whispered. "What about me? I'm not a bad thing, am I?"
"No, you're not. You're the best thing." They sat like that a while, not speaking. Outside, the wind was rising, breathing gently in the gorse and the small trees. Through the eastern windows, they began to see a faint pinkening in the sky. And from below, startling them both, came a voice.
"Fever? Master Thursday?"
Fever threw herself through the doorway, pointing her stolen gun down the ladder. How could she have been so stupid as to leave it unwatched? They were already halfway up the ladder, just two of them this time, two threatening charcoal smudges of shadow in the gathering light, two pale faces gawping up at her from the rusty landing. She was wondering which one to shoot first, when a light flicked on, and she recognised the bloodless glow of an electric lantern.
"Fever, it's me," said Dr. Teal. "Hazel's here too. We've come to rescue you."
"Dr. Teal?" She lowered the pistol, trying to understand. "How did you get past Belkin's men?"
"Oh, it was not so hard. Hazel said we were sure to be smashed on the reefs or seen by the lookouts on the Desolation Row. But the Guild of Engineers always finds a way. We went around that long island east of here so they couldn't see us. Heard gunfire on the way and feared the worst. But we weren't going to give up after coming so far, so we landed Hazel's boat on the southern shore and hiked over the island. No sign of anybody. They must all be on that galley. Is Thursday here? The machine?"
"Who's there?" Arlo was asking worriedly. Fever looked back into the room and said, "It's all right. They're friends. They're here to help." Wondering, as she said it, whether they really could. Whether whatever boat had brought them here could possibly outrun Fat Jargo's galley. They were climbing the rungs now, not in silence like the barefoot octopus men, but with the reassuring pong, pong, pong of boots on rusty ironwork. Dr. Teal clambered onto the platform. He had a pistol in his hand, and he kept it ready as he came inside the tower, Fever backing in ahead of him. He stared hard at Fat Jargo and the other dead men. Fever wished she'd thought to cover them up. The place looked like the Lyceum stage in the last act of a tragedy, except that the blood was not scarlet, but dark and sticky-looking, like spilled treacle, and nobody was about to jump up and take a curtain call.
"You've already had visitors, I see," said Dr. Teal.
Behind him, Jonathan Hazel pulled himself clumsily up onto the platform.
"Merciful gods!" he exclaimed. "What has happened? A massacre!"
"Arlo is injured," said Fever.
"Hazel? Perhaps you should wait below," snapped Dr. Teal. "Not likely. Down there in the dark, with those villains likely to swarm ashore at any instant. Miss Crumb, you are not hurt." "Heavens! Is that Fat Jargo?"
Fever was looking at Dr. Teal's pistol. She had seen it somewhere before, though she wasn't sure where. In a dream? In one of God's Hawk's memory fragments? Northern workmanship. Blue steel and blonde wood. The long barrel decorated with a snarling wolf's head.
"This is Thursday, I presume," he said, looking at Arlo.
"Yes," she started to say. But he was already pushing past her, raising the gun as he walked toward Arlo. His face was changing. He was becoming someone else, the way the actors at the Lyceum did when they stepped out on stage. Becoming someone cold and graceful and absolutely without pity.
"Teal?" said Jonathan Hazel.
Fever was still holding the gun she'd picked up earlier. She turned it in her hand as she stepped after Dr. Teal, gripping it by its barrel. Dr. Teal glanced back, distracted by her movement, and she swung it as hard as she could. The butt of her gun hit him on the temple with a heavy, hollowing-sounding thud. In the plays she'd seen, a blow like that would always knock a man out cold. But the plays had been wrong about that, as they had about so many other things. Teal just said, "Gah!" and doubled over, raising both hands to his head. But for a moment his pistol was pointing at the ceiling instead of Arlo, and Fever took her chance and snatched it from him.
"Fever!"
Arlo shouted.
"He's Vishniak," she said.
"Really, Miss Crum," exclaimed Jonathan Hazel. "This is Dr. Teal, Dr. Avery Teal of the Guild of Engineers."
"No." Fever took a step backward as the engineer staggered and straightened up, glaring at her. She dropped her stolen gun, which she could not even be sure was loaded, and pointed his own pistol at him. It was heavy, and she had to hold it with both hands to keep it pointing at his chest and stop it dropping toward the floor.
"No," she said again. "This is the man who killed Midas Flynn. This is Vishniak. I recognize the gun."
"He killed Flynn?" said Arlo, trying to understand.
"You were there?" asked Teal, at the same moment.
"Great gods! The bathroom! I knew I heard someone in there."
"Teal, is this true?" demanded Jonathan Hazel.
"His name's Vishniak!" shouted Fever.
"Lothar Vishniak is a role I sometimes play," said Dr. Teal. "A mask I put on as part of my work."
He took his hand away from his injured head and studied it quizzically, as if expecting blood. Then his dark eyes looked at Fever again, and she could tell he was gauging the distance between them, making ready to jump at her and try to reclaim his gun.
"And are you really an engineer?" asked Hazel, sounding indignant. "Or is that just another role you sometimes play?"
"Of course he isn't," said Fever.
"Oh, but I am," said Dr. Teal, or Vishniak, or whatever he was called.
He sighed and raised his hands, as if accepting that he would have to explain himself.
"The duties of the Guild have evolved somewhat since you left London, Fever. I work for a new branch, the Suppression Office. It is a secret branch, answerable only to Quercus and the Chief Engineer."
"What is a Suppression Office?" asked Jonathan Hazel. "What is it that you suppress?"
"Ideas, Hazel. Dangerous ideas."
He stepped sideways, and Fever moved with him, keeping herself between him and Arlo, and keeping the heavy gun pointed at him.
"There are certain technologies," he said, "which must not be allowed to develop. When London is mobile, it will become the most powerful city in the world. Nothing will be able to stand before it. But if we allow our rivals to develop air power, for instance, that would change. Even the new London would be vulnerable to attack from the sky. We must make certain that the secret of flight remains lost. So the Suppression Office publishes research proving that flight is impossible and suggesting that anyone who believes it might be is a crank. And whenever we hear of some inventor experimenting with it, an agent is dispatched to see to it that the inventor dies and that his discoveries die with him."
"That's really, really irrational," said Fever. "I didn't bring you here to murder this boy," said Jonathan Hazel.
"Yes, you did, Hazel," replied Dr. Teal. "You just didn't know that was why you were bringing me here."
He looked at Fever.
"You know how ideas spread, Fever. They're like germs. The dangerous ones must be stamped out at their source before they can infect too many minds. I was sent to Felona to eliminate Edgar Saraband, and eliminate him I did. I befriended him and sabotaged that engine of his. He bragged that his flying machine was all his own work. But I found some letters from young Thursday in his workshop, and I learned that he had sent a crate to Maida shortly before his unfortunate accident. So I came here to Maida to find Arlo. It was just by chance that I found you too."
"And you used me to spy on Arlo," realized Fever. "People kept asking me who I was working for, and I said nobody. But I was working for you all along."
"I am not a monster," said Dr. Teal. Everyone told me that Thursday was just a harmless eccentric. I did not want to kill him unless I was certain that he was building a workable machine. I planned to break into that funicular of his, but when I learned that you were in Maida, I realized I could use you as my agent. I followed you out onto the cliffs that first night and let you see the prototype glider I'd brought with me from Saraband's workshop. That whetted your interest, didn't it? The next day, when I mentioned Thursday to you, I was sure you'd take the bait and go to see him, and that he had let you in, since you're such a pretty girl. But you're also an engineer, which made me feel confident that you would let me know if you found anything worth knowing. Feva recalled how proud she'd felt to have discovered Arlo and his work, how eagerly she'd gone to tell Dr. Teal about it. She said, "It was me who told you about Midas Flynn. And that same night you went and killed him."
"I'd have got Thursday too, but when I called at his house earlier that evening, he had already fled.
It wasn't the first time Flynn had come nosing around one of my targets. He had to be removed from the game. I had no idea at that time that the Octopus Cartel was involved too. Imagine the danger we'd all be in if they got access to flying troop carriers and bomb platforms."
"But I didn't build the Goshawk to attack things," said Arlo, who had been listening silently. "Feva, I just wanted to fly."
Feva turned to look at him, hoping he understood that she had planned none of this, knew nothing about any of it.
"Feva," said Dr. Teal, "I have nothing personally against this young man, but even if he only used this machine to take pleasure flights over Maida, other people would see it and be inspired and build machines of their own, and evolution would set in, as it always does with a new technology, and before long we would be facing aerial gunships and all sorts of trouble.
Don't you see? For London's sake he must be removed from the game," said Feva. Dr. Teal smiled a thin smile.
"Quite. Now give me back my gun and let me do my job. Are you an engineer, or aren't you?"
Feva thought about that for a second. Then she used her toe to shove the pistol, which she had discarded earlier, to Arlo, who picked it up and pointed it at Teal. She passed the engineer's pistol to Jonathan Hazel and went to fetch a length of spare cord from one of Arlo's toolboxes. She dragged Dr. Teal's hands behind him and tied them securely using good, rational engineer's knots.
"Now what?" asked Jonathan Hazel.
Feva hadn't really thought about it. She quickly considered their situation. It was not good. Dawn was coming. Offshore, Fat Shargo's men would be preparing another attack.
"We have to get away from here," she said. "We'll take your boat."
"They'll catch us," the merchant objected. "There's no way we can outrun that galley."
"They won't be after us," said Feva. "It's Arlo they want, and Arlo will be flying back to Maida." She turned to Arlo.
"You must do what you always planned to. Fly the Goshawk across and land it in Maida. Let everybody see what you've created. Then your idea will be free in the world and there'll be no point in anyone trying to stop it anymore."
"Feva, I can't," said Arlo.
He was sitting at the foot of the stairs, propping Dr. Teal's gun against the handrail.
"I can't move my arm. There's no strength in my hand.
I can't fly the Goshawk like this. I'm sorry.
You'll have to do it."
She started to protest, but she knew that he was being rational. His wounded arm in its sleeve of bloody bandage looked stiff and lifeless, like something that did not belong to him.
"Don't you dare, Feva," warned Dr. Teal. "Burn the machine, the plans too. That way the Octopus won't get hold of it, and I'll make an exception and let Thursday go."
"Really?"
asked Feva.
"He's lying," said Arlo. "You can see that he's lying."
"How?" wondered Feva. But she knew Arlo's instincts for such things were better than hers, so she tore another strip from his ruined shirt and gagged Dr. Teal to stop him saying any more. Outside, the eastern sky had turned that shade of pink you see sometimes on the insides of seashells. A brisk west wind blew scraps of cloud along.
"I've never flown before," she said.
"Nor had I
before yesterday," said Arlo.
"You'll soon get the hang of it."
Chapter 27 Fever in the Air. So there she hung, in the harness of the Goshawk, wishing that there had been time to make even a short test flight with the new engine. The sky to westward was twilight grey, the sea still, a bright planet hanging just above the horizon. The wind blew in her face. Angels hung on the updrafts above the tower. Their grief over Weasel seemed forgotten now. They were just curious to see whether the machine would fly any better this time. Fever tried to imagine herself landing the Goshawk in Maida, explaining herself to the people who came gathering around to gawp and wonder. It was hard to believe that they would listen, but she could think of nothing else to do. Arlo leaned over her, fumbling one-handed with the Taurus inside its new housing. After a moment, Fever felt it start up. It sent vibrations rippling through all the spars and cables, through all her bones, her tensed muscles. Fever threw a switch to complete the circuit and felt the vibrations change as the propeller started turning faster and faster, the Goshawk straining forward. She shouted to Jonathan Hazel, "Now! Now!" And he leaned all his meagre weight against the tail bar, pushing, running with the machine as it began to move. The tower's edge rushed at her, sped past, and she was in the air. She almost stalled and dropped backward into the cliff face, but recovered in time, straining at the flap and rudder controls, easing the machine up and away, over the dead keys, over the sea. She had a dizzying view for a moment, over the aisles and stacks to northward. Saw a scattering of postage-stamped sails that must be Maida's fishing fleet, and a bigger ship lying on the far rim of the sea. All she could hear was the wind sighing over paper and singing through rigging. The creak of wood and cordage, the purr of the Taurus was too faint to reach her. She flew with no more noise than an angel. Then, as she turned the Goshawk's nose toward the east, Maida itself came into view, and the red galley, and three small boats lying black as splinters on the bright water halfway between the galley and Arlo's island. They had already seen her. She could see men standing up in them, waving to each other, pointing. When she aimed the Goshawk at them and went swooping down, a man panicked and threw himself into the sea. She wished she had brought a stone or something to drop on them, but she had nothing. All she could do was look down at the stupid, shouting, upturned faces as she wheeled above them. One man raised an arquebus, and she saw the white spurt of smoke as he fired it at her. But she didn't think that he could hit her. She went higher just in case, and now the boats were behind her, and she was rushing through the sunlit air, her escort of angels stretching out on either wing. She had never felt so alive, and she found herself thinking that if she did fall and die, it would be worth it just to have felt this soaring freedom. But she saw no reason why she should fall. The Taurus was working just as she had hoped, and the sense of impending danger that had been with her all through the launch was fading steadily as she learned to trust the Goshawk. She banked from side to side, veering through the flock of excitable angels. Glancing back, she saw that the boats had caught up with the galley, and that their crews were scrambling up her sides, the galley herself already turning and getting under way. It occurred to her that she should give the octopus men some hope of catching her. Without encouragement, they might give up and go ashore, in the hope of finding plans or something in the tower, and find Arlo and Jonathan Hazel, too. She took the Goshawk down low again, remembering how mother birds sometimes feigned injury to lure predators away from their chicks. Perhaps Fat Jargo's men would think that the machine was damaged. That would make them pursue it even more eagerly, and stop them wondering about who might be left behind on the island. So she glided above the crests of the waves, spattered with water whenever one rippled into foam. On her right, the Goshawk's shadow scudded along, looking like some huge ray keeping pace with her just under the surface. In the north, the big ship she had noticed earlier had drawn nearer, and resolved itself into three ships sailing close together in a tight formation. That worried her faintly. Could it be more octopus galleys? Reinforcements summoned by the captain of the Desolation Row? But surely they would not send three. and they would be coming from the south, from the Middle Sea, not from the north. A breathy boom came from behind her. It sounded like an exhausted thunderclap, and she could not think what it meant, until she banked and circled and saw the galley fire a second shot, a jab of orange flame from the big gun in that swivelling wooden turret on its forecastle. The projectile went whining past just off the tip of her right-hand wing and kicked up a splash of spray about 100 yards beyond her. By the time the sound came across the water to her, the galley had already fired again, and she was climbing, climbing, striving to get out of range. She had not reckoned with gunfire. Fat Jargo had wanted the machine in one piece, hadn't he? But maybe whoever had succeeded him as commander of the galley wasn't so bothered about that. Maybe he would be content to smash it from the sky and see what he could learn from the wreckage. Maida still looked a long way off. She pushed hard on the altitude lever, and the Goshawk climbed gamely, the Taurus thrumming, the distant booms of the big gun fading behind her. But there was a new noise now, a rattling, hissing sound that she was certain had not been there when she first took off. She craned her head about, trying to find the cause of it. There was a hole in the left-hand wing. She couldn't think that it had been made by one of the shells from the big gun. It was too small, and they had not come close enough. Perhaps that man who had fired his gun at her when she circled the boats had been a better shot than she had allowed for. At any rate, the hole was there, and getting steadily bigger as the wind worried at its edges. She had a listing sensation, as if the right-hand wing was lower than the left. She tried altering her balance in the harness, but it made no difference. The wing was starting to break up. She did not feel free or ecstatic any more. Carefully reciting numbers from the Fibonacci series to try to keep herself calm, she began easing the Goshawk back down, reasoning that if she was doomed to drop into the sea, it would be better to do it from 6 feet than 600. She glanced over her shoulder and saw the galley coming after her, perhaps 2 miles behind. She wished now she'd not tried to be so clever, wished she hadn't taunted them or tried to be a mother bird. Hoping to get well ahead, she adjusted the Taurus control to give her more speed. It was a bad mistake. As the Goshawk powered forward, the stresses on its injured wing increased. A supporting strut snapped with a sound like a pistol shot. A loose cable lashed Fever's face. The Goshawk flipped over, and suddenly she was not the pilot of a flying machine any longer, just a frightened girl dropping into the sea in a tangle of ripped paper and splintering wood. The horizon cartwheeled over her. She heard the angels screeching. Then the sea slapped her hard, and she was underwater. Blue and white and a blizzard of bubbles, some of which were caused by all the air in her lungs rushing out and making for the surface. She struggled with the buckles of the harness. She couldn't tell whether she was 10 fathoms deep or the wreck was floating on the waves, and she just happened to be underneath it. It didn't matter much anyway, since she could drown just as well in either place. The buckles were too stiff. She strained at them and couldn't shift them, and then, at the last moment, as her vision darkened and coloured stars started to swim inside her head, she wrenched herself free of the straps without undoing them, fought against the drowning machine for a terrified moment, and burst up, gasping into the sunlight. The Goshawk was afloat, crumpled, shattered, barely recognisable as the graceful thing of 30 seconds earlier. It rode the long swell like a clot of flotsam, which, Fever supposed, as she dragged herself onto the rudder, was all it was now. One wing, dragged upright by a taut tangle of rigging, poked into the air like a boat's sail, like a paper tombstone, like a signpost telling the lookouts at the masthead of the Desolation Row where they could find their fallen prey. She lay on the rudder and tried to catch her breath. The waves that washed over her washed away pink, and she realised that the stinging pain she could feel on her face was a deep gash caused by that flailing cable end. If it weren't for the goggles, she might have lost an eye. She pulled them off, they'd filled with water anyway, and started trying to think what she should do next. It was hard to concentrate, for loss of blood was making her feel dizzy and stupid. She wondered if she would bleed to death before the galley reached her. But whatever happens, they mustn't find the Taurus. The thought of that powerful little device in the hands of another man like Fat Jago cut through the fog that was starting to wrap her brain. She made herself grope her way along the wallowing fuselage to the place where the engine housing was attached. The Taurus was silent now, broken in the wreck or drowned by the sea. But she couldn't be certain that it was not repairable. So she pulled her knife out of her pocket and set to work, loosening one screw and then the next, until the Taurus came free in her hands. She looked at it, at the battered pale metal that had survived through so many centuries, that her grandfather had held before her. All that power and all that mystery. "I can't just throw it away," she thought. "It needs to be studied. The Order of Engineers should see it." But then she looked up, and the Desolation Row was much closer than she had thought. And anyway, the engineers weren't an order anymore. They were a guild. And even if she could give them the Taurus, they wouldn't use it to fly. Only for something irrational like making an even bigger, faster mobile city. So she opened her fingers, and it slid down the slope of the wing and silently into the sea, where she watched it for a moment going down, fading away from her into the blue depths, as if her offering to the mother below. The beating of the galley's drums came steadily to her across the water, and with it now was another sound, a steady pounding, a throaty throb. She thought at first that it was the blood whooshing and booming in her ears, but then she looked at the Desolation Row and saw that they had heard it too. Men were running about excitedly on the galley's decks, and the gun turret was swivelling, and it wasn't pointed at her any more, but at something else, something in the north. Sleepily, she sat herself up, bracing herself against the struts of her foundering machine. The swell was steepening, and for a moment, down in the coombe between two waves, she could see nothing but sea and sky. Then the next wave heaved the wreckage upward, and her view widened. There was a second ship coming toward her. It was the same one that she had glimpsed earlier, and had mistaken for three ships sailing side by side. Now that it was closer, she could see that it was really one ship with three hulls linked together by thick struts and gantries. A trimaran, she supposed you'd call it. All three hulls were studded with gun emplacements, and as Fever watched, one of the guns went off, and a white spurt of water was flung up just ahead of the Desolation Row. The sea swung her down again into another trough, nothing to see but blue water. When she came up again, she was just in time to watch the galley let off its big gun, the shot falling harmlessly just short of the strange ship. She could see people hurrying along brass-railed walkways on the upper decks of the newcomer, a flag flapping on a tall mast. She squinted at it, and knew it. It showed a wheeled white tower on a black field. The flag of Quercus. The flag of London. "Fever Crumb," she thought, flopping down on her side. "You're hallucinating. Your mind is making up a rescuer for you. There's no point looking at it. It isn't real." But the waves kept hoisting her up, like friendly grown-ups lifting a child up to see a passing parade. She couldn't help but watch. She couldn't help but see the way the Desolation Row started to turn, uncertainly, as the new ship bore down on it. The way the new ship's central hull swept forward into a ram longer and sharper and even more vicious than the galley's. A shell glanced from its ironclad prow. Another made part of its upper works unravel into smoke and splinters, but it kept moving at the same speed, the thump of its engines drumming across the sea, steam and smoke and sparks out of its tall chimneys. It swept past the wreckage of the Goshawk, and its wake lifted Fever even higher so that she could watch as it sliced the Desolation Row in half. The galley's stern rolled over and sank instantly. The bow section floated for a few seconds, the oars still going up and down, as if some of the rowers there hadn't noticed that they no longer had a ship to pull. Then something exploded down beneath the gun turret, blasting orange flame high into the air, sending shards of splintered wood turning over and over up among the circling angels. A man went with them. Fever watched him, waving his arms and legs as he soared up and seemed to hang for a moment in the sunlight as if gravity had forgotten him, before he fell with all the other wreckage and vanished into the rash of white water where the galley had gone down and did not surface. A black clot of smoke rose and spread above the wreck site, trailing long, cloudy tentacles like a phantom squid. The Victoria steamship backed its engines and began to turn toward Fever. And had she been watching still, she would have seen that boats were being lowered from davits on its sides. But by then, she had seen enough. Her eyes closed. It felt peaceful just to lie there, with the salt water prickling as it dried on her skin, and the sun making hot patterns behind her eyelids. The colour of Arlo's kiss. She relaxed her grip on the struts she'd been clinging to. Her own weight slid her gently down the wing, and the waiting sea folded over her like a coverlet. She didn't notice the angels descending. She didn't feel their beaks and fingers hooking her wet clothes, or hear the flap of their wings as they struggled together to keep her from slipping under the water. But somewhere in her dreams, she heard the shouts of the sailors in the approaching boats, who thought that the big birds were trying to eat her.
"Get out of it! Go on! Blog off, you great feathery clouts!"
London voices, she thought. London has come to find me. Chapter 28. Mothership. "Fever, dearest?" Her mother was bending over her. Her mother? She tried closing her eyes and opening them again. "Fever," her mother said. "It's me." And so it was, Wavy Godshawk, with her ash-white hair wound in an elaborate chignon round her beautiful head, and wearing a costume that had been designed by some expensive dressmaker to look slightly like a sailor's uniform, without concealing any of her natural curves. "But where?" Fever sat up and felt salt prickling where the seawater had dried on her skin. The cabin was luxurious, all wood and bronze, with curtained windows, glass-fronted bookcases, soft chairs, a scent lantern playing something cool and minty. There were paintings on the panelled walls, and one of them was a portrait of Fever's father, looking awkward in a stiff-collared tunic. Only the beat of big engines trembling through the walls and floor let her know that she was still at sea. She seemed to be always waking up on strange boats these days. "What ship is this?" she asked. Wavy leaned over her, smoothing a soft hand over her face. "You are aboard the Steam Ram Super Collider, my darling, and you are perfectly, perfectly safe." When Wavy Godshawk had received word from Dr. Teal to say that he had found her missing daughter, she had gone straight to Quercus to ask for a ship that she could take to Maida, and Quercus had lent her the Super Collider. He had built the great steam ram to protect the convoys of shipping that helped feed his new city's hunger for raw materials. But the northern seas were clear of pirates now, and he saw no harm in letting the barbarous southerners see how powerful London's new masters were. He had lent her to Wavy, with his blessing. The voyage south had been brisk, pleasant, uneventful. It was a sort of honeymoon for Wavy and her latest husband, who had both been busy since their wedding, working on the immense task of mobilising London. They had stopped at Cape Britannia to see the famous petrified car park, and touched at Nowhere and Evora too. They had retired to their cabins the previous night, with the lights of Maida twinkling in the south, looking forward to going ashore next day and finding Fever. But before sunrise, Wavy had been woken by the Super Collider's captain, who reported a war galley flying the colours of the Octopus Cartel at anchor off the Ragged Isles. She had gone up onto the quarterdeck in that pearl-pink dawn to see it for herself. A red ship upon a pastel sea. What was the octopus doing there, she wondered. And then, as she watched, she saw that white wing rise from one of the islands, and she knew. So the Thursday machine was really flying, and the naughty octopus had stretched out a tentacle to try to steal its secrets. "Full ahead," she told the captain, and sent a sailor below to rouse her husband. They stood together on the ship's prow in the blown-back spray and watched the new machine sweep eastward, dip and fall, and never guessed that it was Fever flying it. "Take us to where it came down," Wavy ordered the captain. "We must not let that galley reach it first." It wasn't until the galley was sunk and the sailors brought Fever aboard, sodden, lifeless-looking, that red welt across her face still welling blood, that she realized who the pilot of the machine had been. "What about the kite, lady?" they asked her as she knelt down on the deck to take her daughter in her arms. "What about that old-fangled flying contraption?" "Sink it," said Wavy quickly. She did not even bother to stay and watch as the boatman smashed and weighted it and let the sea take it. Fever knew none of that, and there was no time to ask, no time to wonder. This ship, her mother, it all felt like a mystery she could never hope to fathom, like the Taurus, something unreasonable that she would simply have to accept. She looked down at herself. Someone had taken off her wet clothes while she slept and replaced them with a sailor's two big trousers and smock. She touched her face, and there was a soft pad of lint across her gashed cheek. "Don't worry," said her mother. "You're healing remarkably fast. I don't think you'll have a scar." Fever didn't care whether she had a scar or not. She was thinking about Arlo, left alone on that island again. "How long have I been sleeping?" "Not long," said her mother. "You haven't missed much. We've been searching the place where that galley went down, picking up survivors. It was dreadfully boring, but apparently it's a rule of the sea." The captain was most insistent. "At present, we're off Maida at the World's End, negotiating with the authorities there to let us moor in their harbour. They have some silly prejudice against motor vessels, but I expect they'll come around. Now, where is Arlo Thursday, I wonder?" "Arlo's still on the island," said Fever. "So is Master Hazel and Dr. Teal." She looked sideways at her mother. Her beautiful, brilliant, dangerous mother. "How do you know about Arlo and the machine?" "Dr. Teal said he reported only to Quercus and the chief engineer." Wavy laughed. "Oh, Fever, you are out of touch. Did Dr. Teal not tell you?" "He must have wanted to let me surprise you. He's such a sweet man. You see, I am the chief engineer. Dr. Staling kept raising stuffy objections to all Quercus's plans. So Quercus fired him and gave me his job. Oh, Fever, you simply must come back to London and see how well things are going." "He was going to kill Arlo," said Fever, pushing herself upright. "Well, he had good reason," said Wavy. "That flying machine was most impressive. We can't have things like that flapping around. They would ruin everything. We'll send a boat to the island and deal with Senor Thursday."
"You mean kill him?" said Fever.
"Well, if you insist on being crude about it, yes." Wavy looked curiously at her. "Does he mean something to you, this Thursday boy?" She reached out and stroked Fever's hair. "Poor Fever. He's only a common or garden Homo sapiens, you know. There are loads more where he came from." A knock at the cabin door interrupted her. It opened, and a sailor leaned in and said,
"Captain's compliments, ma'am. A small boat is approaching from the islands."
"Is Dr. Teal aboard?" asked Wavy sharply.
"No, ma'am. Two gentlemen, ma'am. Strangers both."
"Arlo and Master Hazel," said Fever.
Wavy glanced quickly at her, and Fever could see that the news had worried her. If the suppression office was as secret as Dr. Teal had said, the chances were that no one else aboard this massive ship knew what she had planned for Arlo Thursday. If he had stayed on the island, she might have been able to have him killed and claim it was an accident. But she could hardly have him assassinated aboard the Super Collider, with her whole crew looking on. Wavy, being Wavy, recovered almost instantly. "Come," she said pleasantly, offering Fever her hand to help her off the bunk. "Let's go and meet your friends." To the sailor, she added, "We shall have to send a boat to the island to collect Dr. Teal. And will you please tell Dr. Crumb that his daughter is awake?" Fever, who had been thinking frantically of ways to keep Arlo safe, thought she had misheard at first. "Dr. Crumb is here too," she asked. Wavy looked at her with that expression of mischievous delight that meant she knew something startling that Fever didn't.
"Of course he's here.
It would have looked most peculiar if I'd left him at home. He is my husband." They met Dr. Crumb on the way to the quarterdeck. He had gotten Wavy's message and he was running to find them, but as soon as he saw them he stopped running and tried to look as if he had not been hurrying at all, because although he had a wife and a daughter, he was still an engineer, and displaying emotion was difficult for him. Difficult for Fever, too. It had been such a long time since she had seen him, and she still wasn't sure how she felt about her discovery of 2 years earlier that he was really her father, not just her guardian. She had no idea what she should make of his marriage to Wavy, but she didn't think she liked it. She thought she wanted him all to herself. She wanted him the way he had always been, bald and indoorsy and white-coated. But he had changed as much as she had. He looked better fed and better dressed, and he had let his grey hair grow until it was about a half-inch long and stood upright all over his scalp like an experiment with magnets and iron filings. She started to run to him, and slowed, and stopped an arm's length away, and gave him a neat little engineerish bow. "Hello, Dr. Crumb."
"Fever," he said,
fidgeting uneasily with a small telescope he had brought with him from the quarterdeck.
"This is... I mean..."
"Oh, that we've found you. That is... it is..."
"Most satisfactory." He couldn't stop looking at her. Her hair, her clothes, her long tanned hands, the dressing that she wore like a mask.
"Your face. You're hurt."
"It's not bad," lied Fever. "Wavy says..."
Wavy took her hand, took Dr. Crumb's. It was the first time that their strange little family had ever been all together in the same place, and it silenced them. They stood there together on the swaying deck while sailors hurried past them and the sun slid into their eyes. The supercollider was turning, spray from her paddle wheels drifting like a cool mist across her upper works. Fever saw that the cliffs of Maida and the harbour mouth were quite close on her left-hand side, and that a small boat was sailing up on her right.
"Dr. Crumb," she asked, "might I borrow your telescope?"
He gave it to her, very glad to find that she still needed him for something. She extended the telescope and trained it on the boat. After a moment's trouble focusing, she saw Jonathan Hazel at the helm, and Arlo sitting in the front, leaning against the mast. Her father had turned to look at the boat too. Marines were running to the supercollider's rail, to aim muskets at it and shout at the merchant to lower his sail, but the boat was already slowing, the sail already rattling down. Jonathan Hazel had stood up uncertainly in the stern and was shouting something, his words lost in the slap of the waves against the supercollider's side.
"Who are those people?" Dr. Crumb was asking.
"The young man is Arlo Thursday," said Fever.
"The inventor of that remarkable flying machine?"
Her father looked pleased, and she knew that at least he did not know about Wavy's plans.
"He must be a very talented engineer. I was most vexed when our clumsy sailors let his machine sink. I shall look forward to making his acquaintance."
"I imagine that Wavy will want to hand him over to the suppression office," said Fever, looking at her mother.
Wavy flushed a little.
"The suppression office?" asked Dr. Crumb. "What is that?"
"Nothing," said Wavy.
"A misunderstanding. Nothing more." The boat was close now, and sailors were throwing down lines advising Jonathan Hazel to
"hook on, mate."
Dr. Crumb went hurrying along the supercollider's deck toward the place where the newcomers would climb aboard, and Wavy would have gone with him, but Fever caught her by a sleeve and held her back. She knew that there was no point in trying to persuade her mother that the suppression office was irrational, but maybe she could meet its madness halfway, suggest some compromise that could keep Arlo safe. As quickly and as calmly as she could, she said, "You can't hope to stamp out flying machines in this piecemeal way.
Murdering inventors won't work in the long term. Someone else will always have the same idea, even if you deal with Arlo. There must be dozens of people all over the world working toward the conquest of the air.